so am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight. Oh.
So, take a look.
What is it really that is in your head? One little life that you had just died. I'm gonna be the one that's taking over. Now this is what it's like when worlds collide.
Another edition of Review Away. I'm John Pollock, joined by Wei Ting. And Wei, we've deviated from our pattern of sorts today, because today we're actually reviewing what is considered one of the best pay-per-views of all time, the AAA When Worlds Collide pay-per-view, which took place November the 6th, 1994, from Los Angeles, California, at the LA Sports Arena.
Yeah, that's right, John. And for those people who haven't seen this show or are just not familiar with Lucha Libre in general, what is the background on AAA?
AAA, obviously, was a promotion that Conan and Antonio Pena, they were part of CMLL, as it's currently known. At the time, it was EMLL. They broke away from that and took a huge chunk of the roster. It was in 1992 that I believe they separated and then created the AAA promotion. It was basically to create an alternative and go in a different direction than the traditional CMLL, which has been around about 76 years.
Right.
So it obviously led to a lot of heat between Conan and Paco Alonso, who's the promoter of CMLL.
Mm-hmm.
And this was their promotion, and one of their big goals was to make it into the U.S. So this was part of that, going over into the U.S. and then presenting this pay-per-view where they were working together with World Championship Wrestling. So this was actually presented by WCW, though it had really no resemblance to the WCW product, as
absolutely
we will see
not
throughout this show. But that's how it turned out. And the announced crew we had for this was Chris Cruz and Mike Tenay. And Chris Cruz was employed by WCW at the time. And actually, they basically threw this out to all the WCW commentators. Nobody wanted to do it. Tony Schiavone didn't want to do it. Nobody at the time.
Hmm.
And Chris Cruz volunteered. He's like, hey, I'll do the show. And Tenay obviously was a
thank
huge
goodness
asset on this show.
Oh my God, both these guys are tremendous.
I thought both did a great job. So we'll get into the pay per view. It's When Worlds Collide, a pay per view that tons of people have heard of, but I don't know how many people have actually seen the show. Definitely, I thought living up to 15 years later, still a very strong show. We had Chris Cruz, Mike Tenay. We then had intros from Arturo Rivera for the live crowd. This was a very Hispanic audience in L.A.
Yes, it was. First match, the Minis.
Espectrito and Jerito Estrada against Octagoncito and Mascarita Sagrada.
Mm-hmm.
And these were all Octagoncito and Mascarita Sagrada, all miniature versions of their larger incarnations.
Was Mascarita Sagrada a miniature version of somebody as well?
I believe that's what they said. Of I don't know.
Okay, well,
that's what they said on the broadcast.
We'll
but
look
I
it up afterwards. But yeah, Octagoncito, the smaller version of Octagon, who we'll see later on tonight as well. And take us through the match, John.
Well, we had the dueling referees. We had the babyface referee, Pepe Casas, and then the heel referee wearing the suspenders was Tarantas. And they gave, I thought Tenay and Cruz, they did such a good job of giving a backstory, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of people were probably tuning into AAA for the first time, not familiar with the differences, because there are quite a lot when you
mm-hmm.
move over to Lucha Libre. I mean, if you're a worker, it's working the different side of the body. But as a viewer, you're not used to the 2 out of 3 falls concept,
mm-hmm.
having two referees.
Yeah.
I mean, just the tag format in that,
oh,
you
yeah.
know, basically you don't have to tag a guy to get in. So I thought they did a very good job of not trying to be over detail heavy on it,
yeah.
but just giving broad strokes of the differences.
It was a very, very authentic presentation, and but it was very much catered towards the American audience, as we saw.
They explained that the height limit for the Minis division was 5'0", and that's how Jerito Estrada was able to make it in at 4'8".
Wow.
And if you know, Wei, yeah. actually, when Rey Mysterio was debuting, he was originally pegged to be a Mini.
Oh, no kidding.
But he thankfully was not.
Hmm.
They referred to Espectrito as a martial arts expert, Wei. Did you feel this fact was a valid one?
Well, I'm an expert on martial arts.
Because you're Asian?
Yes.
Oh.
And I did not feel that way. from watching the match, I was really, really impressed with the two smaller faces in the match, Mascarita Sagrada and Octagoncito. Just the acrobatics in this match were tremendous.
This was a very, very well-worked match. Mm-hmm. They worked to, there was a back body drop by Octagoncito onto Espectrito, and then a moonsault by Sagrada. Very, very slow cover by Casas, and Chris Cruz called him on it. Mm-hmm. It was, to me, a little anticlimactic in that you had this great high spot to end the match with the moonsault, and then Casas, it took forever to get on his knees to cover.
I don't know if it was the audio quality on the tape or what, but like it seemed that the crowd didn't really pop for a lot of the finishes. They just the three counts would occur, and then like the audience would just kind of remain at the same level.
They seemed the most heated for the entrances,
yeah,
and just kind of the presentation of these characters coming out. Then all of a sudden, I Just Can't Get Enough was playing in the arena, and this led to our next match. It was a six-man tag with Fuerza Guerrera, Psicosis, and Madonna's boyfriend, who was Louis Spicoli, with the joke, Madonna's boyfriend, as if there could only be just one, because Madonna's a slut.
Yes.
And they were taking on the team of Latin Lover, Heavy Metal, and Rey Mysterio Jr. And boy, was the Jr. in Rey Mysterio emphasized. He was 5'2", 149 pounds is what they listed him as.
And this was a 19-year-old Rey Mysterio Jr., perhaps his first appearance on North American television?
In 1994, this would have been before ECW. So, yeah it would have been for that major of an audience. Now, for the six-man tag here, this is where it's a little confusing, where they have two captains. Fuerza Guerrero was the captain on one side and Heavy Metal on the other. So either you could pin the captain to win the match, or you would have to pin both of the other members of the team to win the match. So,
Fuerza Guerrero, for those who don't know, is the father of Juventud Guerrero,
who was nowhere on this show.
Nowhere on the show. And yes, he was the captain, along with Heavy Metal, who's the brother of Negro Casas, and also the son of one of the referees that you had mentioned earlier.
That was Pepe Casas.
Pepe Casas. Yes.
That's right, because I have it written down here. It was slightly a conflict of interest, I thought, having Heavy Metal and his father.
Well, they mentioned outright that one of the referees is for the heels, the others for the faces. So
it would be like Jesse Taylor fighting, and John McCarthy was refereeing a fight. Be a conflict
really.
Of interest, father and son.
No, they're not really father and son.
What else? We had Spicoli was no selling for Ray early on, and he would continue dancing. And I enjoyed these heel tactics from Spicoli.
I think so too. It was a lot of fun, and they did a really good job of this match. In this match, introducing foils for each of the wrestlers. You have Fuerza Guerrera and Heavy Metal, who are obviously the two captains in this match, and who used to be tag team partners. Then you also have the two heartthrobs of each team, which were Madonna's boyfriend and Latin Lover.
The heartthrobs.
The heartthrobs, yes.
Latin Lover, everyone was announced as a former stripper, and he was the babyface.
That's right, yes.
Which
is legit. And then obviously you have Psicosis and Rey Mysterio Jr., two guys who trained together and became lifelong friends and enemies.
Yes. Cruz noted during Spicoli's dancing that, white man can't dance. He's giving us a bad name.
Oh, man.
That was...
But you can dance, John.
I can dance tremendously, Wei. I can also do somersaults, which is what...
which you can see on YouTube.
Which is what Rey Mysterio did to a laying Spicoli on the floor off the top rope. And the finish came with Guerrera and Metal in the ring, and Guerrera... I used a submission. I didn't write down what the submission was, and
it was some sort of hammerlock on the floor.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Cruz and Tanay, there was some problems during the broadcast where during this match they weren't sure if it was a 2 out of 3 falls match. It was not, and the team of Fuerza Guerrera, Psicosis, and Madonna's boyfriend got the win. And throughout the show, they were constantly saying, "We have unconfirmed reports that there will be a 6th match tonight." Which never came to fruition.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't know if they had anyone in their ear or just they didn't know what was going on this show. But this was an awkward segue. They then had to go plug the WCW hotline and the upcoming Starrcade 1994 show, headlined by Hulk Hogan and Brutus Beefcake.
Yeah, it was
which
odd.
Seemed just completely out of left field on a show of this caliber.
Uh-huh.
Next up, another 6-man tag. We had the team of Pegasus Kid, Chris Benoit, who is the captain of the team, with Too Cold Scorpio and Tito Santana taking on Blue Panther, La Parca, and Jerry Estrada, Blue Panther the captain on that team. So they noted that Chris Benoit
not loved in his home country of Canada, which is true 15 years later, I guess.
Yeah. Back then, well, okay.
This was an awkward match to watch. Wait, let's just get this out of the way.
It was
right
not
now.
Awkward for me. Like,
I have not watched a Chris Benoit match since he murdered his family. This was the first match I did because it was in the name of work.
I have no problems watching a Chris Benoit match. In fact, like
I do.
Well,
I just to me it takes out my enjoyment of the match because okay. whenever he's in the ring, I am only thinking of Chris Benoit, how we know him.
And
I think
that's true.
And I think that takes it out of you. It'd be like watching. You know, it would be like watching O.J. Simpson play a charity football game. Well, could you really enjoy the football game? Let's talk about
if
this.
It was
this was a big hurdle for
if
me.
If this was O.J. Simpson now playing a football game, yeah, it would be tough. But
If he played.
But watching old tapes of the Buffalo Bills from way back then. He played for the Bills, right?
Yes.
Yes. From way back then, I don't think would be tough.
I think it's a very valid comparison because O.J. Simpson was considered one of the best running backs sure. of his era. And I think Chris Benoit easily one of the best workers of his time. I'm just saying that I...
No, that's fine.
It took it out of the match for me watching Chris Benoit.
And it's all very subjective whether or not you can separate that from the work itself.
There was a reference to the latest movie, True Lies, which really put us in a time warp here. There was a spot where Chris Cruz noted that it's ironic that Tito Santana is Mexican, but has spent most of his career outside of Mexico.
Yep. They build this as, you know, even though Santana is the veteran in this match, he has least Mexican experience amongst all the participants.
Chris Benoit was listed as 5'5", 190 pounds.
Okay.
190 pounds.
Yeah. Well, no, not
He really worked out. Would it be fair to say this is one of the best pay-per-views you've seen, Wei?
Definitely by far amongst the ones we've reviewed. One of the best ever I've seen.
Would it be a top five candidate?
In terms of work rate, I would have to think back, but yeah, I would say so in terms of work rate.
Would it be fair to say that Heroes of Wrestling would be in your bottom five?
Yes.
And do you know the link to those shows?
Too Cold Scorpio.
There you go. Too Cold Scorpio was on both shows.
He was, yes. Scorpio making his second appearance on a review away in a row. This match, I just noted that Chris Benoit obviously is somebody we're probably the most familiar with amongst all this, all the participants. And his style wasn't really too drastically different. I was expecting a very different Benoit from what we were used to seeing years back in the WWE. And really, like, his style was pretty much the same, just fast as ever and stiff as ever.
Very, very hard style he was working at this point and continued it up. The finish came with Benoit. It was a Hurricane Rana into a pin onto Blue Panther and got the win. And since Blue Panther was the captain, obviously, that was the end of the match just with the one fall. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on this match, Wei?
The crowd was really, really
crowd was unbelievable.
For La Parca, especially.
Yeah, they were really, really into La Parca in this one. We then went to another promo for an upcoming Clash of Champions, where the main event was going to be Hulk Hogan, Sting, and Dave Sullivan taking on The Butcher, Avalanche, and Kevin Sullivan.
The three faces of fear.
And while Mike Tenay was chatting about the upcoming match, Cruz had to cut him off to throw to a Starrcade promo.
It was odd.
It was forced.
And it really just gave you a comparison of what WCW was doing at the time compared to what else was out there.
Amazing.
I could only imagine watching this pay-per-view at the time that it occurred and being as big of a fan as I became to be pro wrestling at that point and just being wowed by this work rate. So.
We then go to a match that some would list among the best matches of the 90s. It was the AAA Tag Team Champions Eddie Guerrero and Art Barr, who were part of the Los Gringos Locos stable along with Luis Piccoli, taking on Octagon and El Hijo del Santo, the son of El Santo. And this was going to be a double hair versus double title match.
Yes, as well as two out of three falls.
Yes.
Which got a little confusing for me watching it for the first time.
This was one, the first time I saw this pay-per-view, I was the same as you. It was, if you've never, because this one wasn't explained as well, because you're doing the two out of three falls where you can pin one guy, but then you have to pin the other for it to register as one fall.
Yes.
So this was maybe a Vince Russo style
well,
of booking.
If you're from...
If Russo booked this, we would shit on it. But because it's when worlds collide, it's considered one of the best matches ever.
Well, like, I mean, with that said, this type of match, I'm sure, is very common in Lucha Libre, so the audience was probably very familiar with it.
Here's my thing. We'll get right to the match. Is that a lot of people will shit on certain things and be like, oh, that guy doesn't know how to work. That guy, it doesn't work. To me, it's like the be-all, end-all is how the crowd reacts. Mm-hmm. And this was one of the hottest crowds I've ever heard for a tag match. It was out of this world. So if it clicked with them, then too bad for us. I think this match was excellent.
Yeah.
We had... Eddie Guerrero and Art Barr were... basically, their gimmick at the time as Los Gringos Locos were... that they had turned their back on Mexico, and they were... Art Barr was an American, but Eddie Guerrero had turned his back on Mexico, joined the Los Gringos Locos, and now the Americans here are the heels in L.A. against Octagon and El Hijo del Santo.
Who is the son of probably the most
the
famous...
most famous wrestler, definitely in Mexico, yeah. And along with maybe Ricky Dozan, mm-hmm. Maybe...
Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, I think El Santo is at a different level than Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair. If anyone has been to Mexico, I think this guy has a holiday in his name that is recognized by the entire country. Until we have Ric Flair Memorial Day, I don't know if he's really at that level.
Another aspect of this match they built was how we had the sons of El Santo and Gory Guerrero, who were attacked originally. Competing against each other in this match.
The first fall, it featured a bit of a botched Hurricanrana by Eddie onto Santo. And then they did a suplex.
And then a frog splash from
Art
Barr.
Was it. They did the suplex into the frog splash by Art Barr.
Who invented the move.
Yes, and that was for the first fall. Mm-hmm. And then...
So right off the bat, Los Gringos Locos with the first...
That out of the way 4 minutes into the match. Just a few minutes later, they evened it up with Octagon. He got the second fall on Eddie and Barr. It was a Hurricanrana reversal to pin Eddie, and then he applied an octopus submission onto Barr to get the tap out. So basically, 10 minutes into the match, we had split the fall, and now it was into the big third fall. So the heat was all on that. Art Barr was yelling 187, which Chris Cruz informed us was an anti-immigration bill.
Mm.
So that was
brilliant.
I thought Art Barr was fantastic in this match.
Art Barr was excellent. I think he and Eddie, all four participants were tremendous. But Eddie will always be one of my favorite wrestlers, and it really shows here. Not just in his in-ring work, but his in-ring charisma. Just
Was it, because Barr was like, he was pretty injured at this point, but his charisma was just unbelievable. Knowing when to build to certain moves, and they did that with giving the backstory about the tombstone. The tombstone in Mexico is revered as one of the most devastating maneuvers in Lucha Libre, and they built it up to Barr hitting a tombstone onto Octagon.
Behind the referee's back.
Yeah, and the heat this got was unbelievable. Yeah. And this took Octagon right out of the match, and it did build back to... Blue Panther running into the ring and giving a tombstone to Art Barr, but Barr was able to recover from the tombstone. I wasn't a big fan of that spot because I thought it trivialized the spot on Octagon.
Yeah, but this was a tombstone that Barr delivered to Octagon. The other one was just a regular tombstone.
Pile driver.
Yes.
I don't understand the difference.
Well...
Based on where your head's going in the same direction.
Well, I don't know the difference between a body slam, which is also could also be very dangerous.
But you're landing on your back, not your head.
Well,
it's a huge difference.
Okay. Well, what about a backdrop? What about a German suplex?
That's the back of the head, which technically should be worse, but there's more wear and tear on the neck.
What about a steel chair to the head?
That's bad news.
Okay.
Antonio Pena came out to check on Octagon. We then got a ton of near falls here where they basically booked Santo as Superman. He was able to kick out of a sit-out powerbomb by Eddie, a belly-to-belly suplex off the top rope, a top rope Hurricanrana, a Tiger Driver 91. Then, out of nowhere, someone in the back did a mic check that went through onto the on-air feed.
Mm.
So check 1, 2. It was weird. I don't actually have the finish written down.
Well,
here,
the finish came with just a roll-up out of nowhere from El Santo, or El Hijo del Santo. Some sort of victory roll, and then gets the victory after how long? How long was this match?
This match was a solid, I would say.
Like 20-minute match, yeah.
20 minutes?
Yeah.
This match was, the heat was phenomenal. And then afterwards, Eddie Guerrero and Art Barr had their heads shaved.
Yes.
This was for anyone that's following pro wrestling, this is the one match on the show that you should really go out of your way to check out. Because
this match is on the Eddie Guerrero DVD, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So there's another reason to get that DVD, which is fantastic.
Meltzer rated this 5 stars.
Yeah, then the heat alone made it. It's just heat you don't see anymore in the U.S. So
there was a lot at stake, obviously, with the mask and the hair.
Well, the mask of El Hijo del Santo, when you have him in the right match against the right opponents, it's a gimmick that works tremendously. And it's funny that years later when the WWE started, I don't know if you remember that Super Astro show they ran briefly. It was like in 1999. And they signed El Hijo del Santo, and they wanted to unmask him for the show.
Fuck.
Can you imagine going up to him and just, hey, we're going to take your mask off? He politely said, fuck off. That takes us to our main event of the evening, Conan against Perro Aguayo in a steel cage match, which was billed as the largest steel cage match in history.
It was the same size as any other.
What does the size of a cage matter? I guess in this case, because the winner had to climb out of it.
Yeah.
Does it emphasize climbing skill?
I don't know.
Thought a cage match was to keep people in. What kind of... If you and me were to get into a fight, and... Would we get into a fight in this booth right now and the winner is the first one to get out of that door and out of the studio? What the fuck does that prove?
No,
wouldn't you want to beat the shit out of me so I can't get out?
The point,
I'm beaten.
No, the point is to beat the shit out of the person so that they would not be able to wake up so that you can get out. That's the appeal of it. If you were to just leave as soon as possible, you would be a coward.
How many WWF cage matches always built up to that spot where two guys were racing down the cage at the same time and one won by a sec? What the fuck did that prove? What did that prove? I'm faster than you. I'm tougher than you.
Well, what does a three count prove? A three count...
You're done.
Yeah.
You can't move.
Not necessarily.
I have incapacitated you.
Yeah, but what if it's...
You are prone under my body.
What about a three count with just like a schoolboy where the other person is only down for three counts and not down at all? What if it's like a quick cover?
Would you go to a submission-only style of finishes?
I don't know. We should not carry on this debate.
Cage matches in and of itself, I think, are silly. They're supposed to be a blow-off match. What kind of blow-off is running up a cage and out? Ha ha, I'm faster.
Depends on the match itself. If it's a good match, you have no complaint.
I just thought of this right now. I hate steel cage matches. We move on. Mike Tenay brought up the fact that Conan was in the 1990 Pat O'Connor Memorial Tournament at Starrcade 1990. Yeah. Which was reviewed a few weeks back here on Review Away. 4 minutes into the match, Perro Aguayo did color. And then a graphic came up on the screen. Parental discretion is advised.
I was not familiar with Perro Aguayo, but apparently
this man is loved.
Very much known for his blood, his color in his matchups.
There was a great little line. Tenay got in, mentioning that Conan once headlined the first Triple Mania with Cien Caras back in 1993 in front of 50,000 people in Mexico, and just got that line in there. And it really made the finish make a lot of sense. We had Guerrero and Spicoli come out where they announced that he's got a pair of brass knucks and a cup of Coca-Cola.
Oh, is that what he talked?
He threw brass knucks to Conan and threw a cup of Coca-Cola into the eyes of Perro Aguayo because it's getting blood and Coca-Cola and that syrup mixed together.
Well, because you don't get more American than Coca-Cola.
Disgusting. He should have, Perro Aguayo should have brought out a Tecate beer and thrown it at Eddie. Conan hit a Niagara driver. That was not the finish. Cien Caras then ran out with the other members of the Los Antomicos Dynamita group. I butchered that name. Dynamita?
The Dynamite Brothers is how
the Dynamite Brothers. Thank you, Wei.
I don't know if you noticed in this match, John, but once the Dynamite Brothers came out and they started attacking Eddie and Luis Spicoli, There was a spot where Eddie was up against the rails, and these fans from the audience just start, you know, raining down punches on Eddie Guerrero's head.
Which anyone who has looked at the history of Eddie Guerrero, that's one of the last guys.
Oh, my God.
Like, Eddie has quite the track record of attacking fans.
Yeah. And in this particular match, you could really see it, because for the
rest... Eddie didn't take shit.
For the rest of the evening, Guerrero was just focused on these fans in the audience, ready to punch back. And here you have the Dynamite Brothers trying to hold them back from attacking the audience.
That's great.
This was a bald Eddie Guerrero.
He did not have a good night. No, he really did, actually, when you look in hindsight. Yeah. Aguayo gets the win. After the match, fans were wiping the blood off of Aguayo as, like, a souvenir.
Hey, if you really...
That's gross.
If you really love the guy...
This is a guy that's been in the business for over 35 years. I'm sure he's had a lot of extracurricular activities.
Why would fans let Bushwhacker Luke lick their face?
That's a great point. I can understand Perro Aguayo, the man's a legend, but Luke Williams? I don't know about that.
I don't get it.
Cruz noted that this is going to be a tremendous blow to Conan's career. Remember when losses would be considered devastating to their career?
Yeah.
Remember. If this was a WWE pay-per-view, Conan would beat him the next night on Raw in 5 minutes.
Yes.
That recaps the When Worlds Collide pay-per-view. The tag match was a highlight for me of this show, but really not a bad match on this card. And it's been regarded as one of the best pay-per-views of all time, and I'm definitely not going to dispute that. The crowd heat is just fantastic on this show.
I think solely for its historical significance on introducing Lucha Libre to a whole new audience, it puts this pay-per-view up there at the top. The commentators do an excellent job of doing that. The only complaints we have would be just the detach that they seem to have with the promoters of the show in regards to the rules and all that. But yeah. In terms of work rate, excellent show.
What did you think of Chris Cruz on commentary?
I thought he was good. You didn't like him?
Nope. I liked him a lot. And that brings us to this week's interview on Review Away. John Pollock.
Wow.
I didn't tell you about this.
You're on top of things.
I got a chance to chat with Mr. Cruz for 20 minutes yesterday, and he gave me quite a lot of details on this show. So here it is, one-on-one with Chris Cruz, one of the commentators for When Worlds Collide.
Today on Review Away, we're looking back at one of the more legendary pay-per-views that wrestling has presented, the November 1994 When Worlds Collide pay-per-view. And the two men who called that show were Mike Tenay and our guest today, Chris Cruz, who I'm sure many wrestling fans remember from his days at WCW and part of the When Worlds Collide announced crew. And Chris, thanks a lot for chatting with us. And hard to believe that it's been almost 15 years since that huge show from Los Angeles.
Yeah, you know, thinking back on it, you know, your email got me to thinking about it. What a great time it was. But, you know, just like so much, you don't appreciate it till, you know, till it's past. I remember one time I was thinking, wow, it's been 5 years, and then 10 years, and now kind of on 15 years. And it was really a highlight of my life, professionally and personally. Frankly saddened a little bit by, you know, the fact that Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero were in a tremendous match there, and they're no longer with us. But it was a great event, and it's a great crime that WCW didn't capitalize more on the popularity of Lucha Libre.
Are you at all surprised, Chris, that, I mean, so many pay-per-views come and go, and still when we talk to listeners and other fans, when you're citing off that the top pay-per-views in history, When Worlds Collide is always one that fans seem to bring up, and it's one that really does stand the test of time that so many other shows fail to do?
Yeah, you know, invariably at any appearances I make, people always bring that up. And one of the things that, you know, that really... I think it's great, but at the same time, it's sad, because I think if it was so great, why couldn't somebody within WCW see that? I mean, no announcer within WCW wanted to do it. And I volunteered. I thought, oh, man, this is great. I can't wait. But Tony Schiavone, all the others, they were like, who wants to do that? And thank God for Mike Tenay, because Tenay, with a tremendous background in Lucha Libre, he and I think we went to Tijuana or someplace, a couple of places in Mexico and San Diego, two or three times on our own dime, before doing that event. He, of course, had all of the background. I was really, you know, if any of the color commentary or the play-by-play was good, it's the result of 90% of Mike and his work and his bullet points and his background. It was just a tremendous amount of work that he put into it. And, you know, and looking back on it, you know, every once in a while, in fact, I just bought a bootleg copy of it on DVD at a show a couple of months ago. And you're like, wow, why didn't they capitalize on this? It's a real heartbreaker. And I, you know, as much as it's a heartbreaker for us and, you know, for those who were involved and for the fans, I think it was a real heartbreaker for those who really thought that, you know, within the Lucha Libre community, that this was what was going to propel them. You know what I mean? That this was really going to make Lucha Libre accepted in America. And they deserved it, and they didn't get what they deserved.
Talk to us a bit about the strategy behind yourself and Mike. I mean, traditionally, wrestling fans were accustomed that you would have the straight man and then usually a heel color commentator. And this was very unique in that you had two straight guys calling the show. I mean, was that just because you two were the only ones available, or was that done on purpose for this show?
Well, I think it's both. That's a very good point. I mean, we, you know, clearly Mike was going to be involved in the production, but as to, you know, the play-by-play guy, they just didn't have anybody there, and Shivani and those other turds wouldn't do it. So, you know, I said, well, geez, let me do it. And the great irony of this is that I was part-time at WCW. I was going in, you know, I think one day a week or something, and I was making $36,000 a year, which wasn't bad. I was flying down from my home in North Carolina to Atlanta, go back, and so after that, you know, Eric Bischoff, apparently sensing that other people had interest in me, doubled my salary. So, you know, just that one thing, you know, that one night made me $36,000. So it was such a great, great night. And for them, again, I know I said it before, but not to capitalize on it. Back to the announcer issue, I just think it worked really well. I mean, I don't, you know, I think there was an article done recently where I was interviewed where people were saying, you know, is that the model? Even the model on Raw, Jerry Lawler, yeah, he's clearly a heel, but he's not, you know, this outrageous, notorious heel. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I thought it worked well. I thought, you know, that we knew that we needed to educate the audience, that I was going to be able to call the moves, to call the play, and that Mike was going to be able to give the background and the great, great history of Lucha Libre. And I think it worked out, but I don't think it was as a result of any planning. I won't give anybody in WCW credit for that. It's just that Mike and I were available, and we did it.
Now, something that I've never heard was, how did this relationship start with WCW and AAA? Because it seemed like an odd one from the start. And as you mentioned, it was just really nothing came out of the show for WCW. I mean, how did this whole thing come together?
Yeah, I think that Eric was kind of, I'm trying to think of a timeline of this. Was this before the NWO explosion? I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was right around. It was 94, so it was right before Nitro was about to launch.
Before Nitro, I think Eric was kind of saying, you know, just, he was, at the time, he was just open to anything, and he knew the, you know, like any good promoter, he saw something popular, and he said, well, let me grab, you know, jump onto that bandwagon. And I think Mike Tenay was very instrumental. I mean, he's very, you know, easy to get along with and influential. And I think he was instrumental in establishing that relationship. I didn't know much of the history of it, but yeah, I think if you're any kind of business in America nowadays, and I'm in the mortgage business, you darn well had better look to the Hispanic market, which is now a larger market than the African-American market is. A significant portion, I'm told in the range of 20 or 25% of Raw and SmackDown viewers are Hispanic, and that's why Rey Mysterio is so important to that promotion, WWE. So, yeah, I think that probably it was Eric trying to be, you know, look ahead and seeing, wow, the Hispanic market is going to be huge. Lucha Libre is huge in the Hispanic market. And then some internal politics, or maybe Eric got pulled away with the Nitro and with NWO. I don't know, but it just died. You know, we had this great pay-per-view. We were all, you know, walking in the clouds, and nothing.
And it seemed that it was, I mean, here came a product at a time when the World Wrestling Federation and World Championship Wrestling, they really hadn't hit that peak during the 90s, and all of a sudden, this very unique, work rate heavy product arrives in AAA, and it seemed that it would be a natural that it was going to grow, starting in the LA market, and it seems every couple of years we see AAA try to make some inroads into the U.S., but it ultimately, they stay down in Mexico, and it's always surprised me that AAA, or even, you know, CMLL, haven't been able to make that leap into the U.S. market.
Well, I live in the Washington, D.C. area now, a huge Hispanic presence here. I moved to North Carolina in 1992 and, you know, was pretty involved in my church. I'm Catholic. And in 92, and from 92 to when I moved in 2001, our parish changed from basically, you know, all Anglo, all Caucasian, to all Hispanic in a small town in North Carolina. I'm originally from Maine. I go to Maine a lot, and Maine was and still is the whitest state in America, whiter even than Iowa and North Dakota. But there's a huge population of Hispanics in Maine. So it was a tremendous opportunity for them to capitalize. You know, you can go into small towns and draw 300, 400, and 500 people for a Lucha Libre match. You don't have to be, like you said, in Los Angeles and other areas of Southern California and Houston and, you know, just in the typical kind of Hispanic markets. The other thing, though, that you bring up a very interesting point, it really jogged my memory. You talked about work rate heavy. I do recall some discussion afterwards that the work rate of the Lucha Libradors was such that it put many of the WCW guys to shame, and it wasn't a good comparison. Now, you know, it's just that obviously they really, you know, cranked up their game for the pay-per-view, but I think probably they were maybe if they were at a 10 for the pay-per-view, their normal work rate is probably a 9, so it wasn't doubling of the work rate all of a sudden, you know what I mean? But yeah, the comparison was probably not that good. They could have just opened up a separate company. I mean, the money that could have been made is just extraordinary, but there wasn't, once we did that, something happened. It was like, you know, it was going to be the first of many things. And then as soon as somebody or someone or some group in the company saw that pay-per-view, I think they were determined to kill any relationship with Lucha Libre.
When the show ended, Chris, I mean, what was the immediate reaction for you and Mike? Was it the feeling that, wow, we have just called something that's really, really special? I mean, what was the feeling right after that show?
We knew going in, you know, from talking to the boys in the back, that it was going to be something. And it was that they knew this was the, you know, Lucha Libre's coming out party, a major pay-per-view, and basically sponsored by WCW. We knew a very prominent announcer and I, we watched the tape afterwards, and we knew that the show was consistently good throughout. I think it's probably fair to say that Mike knew that this was an excellent show in terms of work rate. I don't know that we had said either during or just after that it was a classic, but in the days and weeks and months, we were just inundated, and we were kind of flabbergasted. We knew we called, because of Mike's great, you know, background work, we knew we had called an excellent pay-per-view. We knew the pay-per-view itself in the ring was excellent, and, you know, it had enough drama, and it had enough great work rate, and we knew that the arena in Los Angeles, the folks were just really excited. It's almost like the fans smartened up, and they knew it wasn't just another event. It wasn't just another Lucha Libre event, a AAA event. This was on pay-per-view. So they knew, the fans knew this was big. But, you know, we didn't realize it until weeks and months went on. But I think the very thing that killed it was its popularity. I just think that people within WCW either didn't appreciate or didn't like the style. Because, you know, there is kind of sometimes there's a clownish style to some of the matches. Sometimes there's a ballet style to some of the matches. And there's especially in some of the eight-man tags, you know, it can seem like it's really, you know, the moves are prearranged and everything. But that's the style, and that's acceptable. But I think some folks in WCW just did not like it. And look, hey, they succeeded. They killed it.
That's absolutely true. I mean, that's one of the legacies of the show, that just enough wasn't done afterwards. But I wanted to talk about looking up and down the card. I mean, some amazing performances by a number of different guys. But for me, and I just went back and watched it this past week, really the performer that stood out to me the most was, who you mentioned earlier, Art Barr, who seemed just at another level of heat that you just do not see in wrestling 15 years later. Talk to us a bit about Art Barr, and, you know, this is a tragic story that here he had this high point and just a few weeks later passed away.
Yeah, it was heat. It was charisma. And I'm glad you mentioned that you watched it recently, because it was also the technical ability. You know, Eddie has alluded in his book to the fact that, you know, he did a lot of the work and Art did, you know, a lot of the heat drawing, and it's true. But it wasn't like a 90-10 split, you know, it was more like 60-40. Eddie, obviously very technically proficient, but Art was very proficient as well. And he had the psychology down. I knew he had some personal demons, but he was poised for a major, not at the Hulk Hogan level, but a major run with a major promotion in the United States. I think he sensed that. You know, he'd had some ups and downs previously, and I think he said, look, I'm gonna go out and I'm gonna make my career, and he did, but unfortunately his demons caught up with him, and as you mentioned, just weeks later he was dead.
And that to me is just a real scary stat right there, that you look at both Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero, and even Louis Spicoli, who was part of that group with them. I mean, 15 years later, and all three of them gone. It's just it's a sad part looking back at some of these old tapes and realizing that it seems every match, it's like you can point out a guy that's no longer here.
Yeah, you can. In fact, some old WWF pay-per-views say dead. He's dead. He's out. He's crippled. You know what I mean? And you're like, wow, was it really worth it? So yeah, it is sad, but yeah, certainly Art and Eddie are the saddest, because they were clearly the stars. I mean, they were, I guess I call them Lucha Libre Plus. I mean, they could work the Mexican style, they could work the American style, and they would have made a ton of money. And it is one of the great sadnesses. And, you know, the great sadness obviously is that they're no longer with us. And the other great sadness, like I say, is the great irony is that, you know, the very success of the pay-per-view kind of led to, I think, the dissolution of any partnership. There was somehow within WCW a threat. They felt threatened. Instead of it being seen as a complementary business, it was seen as a business that could tear WCW down, and that wasn't the case at all.
We'll finish off, Chris, just with your final thoughts. Kind of when you hear When Worlds Collide, I mean, what will the legacy of that show be? Because it's one that it's still a pay-per-view that people still recall. It's 15 years later.
I want to do it again. That's what I feel every time I see it and talk about it and think about it. And, you know, that seems kind of glib, but what's to stop, you know, McMahon from doing a Lucha Libre pay-per-view right now? I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just the whole industry that feels that way about Lucha Libre, but why hasn't somebody seen this as a moneymaker? I mean, McMahon is struggling against MMA. You know, people have seen, you know, the same stuff from TNA and WWE, and now they're going to MMA. Well, you put Lucha Libre on pay-per-view, and I think you've got a pretty decent run for a couple of years. It's an extraordinary opportunity, and it's really a story of missed opportunity, and it's a story of what can really happen in terms of delivering a great performance to the viewers when all of those elements come together. It's also kind of a cautionary tale in what can happen when you don't recognize what something can do for you as a company. It would have required some changes within WCW. There would have been maybe some changes in personnel, but I think had they capitalized on that and not gone the Hulk Hogan NWA route, we might still be talking about the Monday Night Wars even now.
Wow, excellent job, John.
Thank you, Ray. It was that was honestly one of the most enjoyable interviews I have ever done. He was fantastic to chat with, and definitely said any time in the future to come back on Review Away.
This is great. Will this be an ongoing thing for a special?
If there's an event that we do and there's a chance to, you know, give some extra behind-the-scenes perspective on it, like a Bill Stone or a Chris Cruz, I think we should absolutely do it.
Cool.
I forgot to get all the feedback, because we did get a fair amount this past week, so next week we'll double up and get all the feedback in. As much as I enjoyed this pay-per-view way, I do have to say I enjoy the crappier shows.
Mm.
I think I have a lot more to comment on.
All right.
This show was just good.
I like sitting down and watching good wrestling. I mean, I don't...
We'll vary it up. We'll vary it up. But I think the next 2 weeks...
What did you rate this show, by the way?
Oh, we didn't even do the...
No,
the rate.
We did.
You know what? I'm going to say 9 out of 10.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of giving 10 out of 10s. Unless,
yeah.
It's hard to say perfect, but I'm going to give this 9 out of 10.
We rate these on a very personal scale.
Yes.
And for me, because I was not familiar with a lot of the people going into the match, I would only rate it maybe like an 8.5, but if I was a fan, I'm sure it would be higher.
Mm-hmm. This would have been an awesome show to watch live.
Mm-hmm.
If I was there, it probably would have been head and shoulders above any show.
Cool.
To see live. So I was thinking next week, because we do have Halloween coming up, and in 2 weeks we'll do the big Halloween Havoc 95, but I was thinking next week maybe we could take a look at the final Halloween Havoc from 2000 away.
Oh, boy.
Featuring Chronic versus Bill Goldberg and Scott Steiner versus Sid.
Shit.
Are you game for that?
I guess I'll have to be.
Come on, Way. I think we have to. We
Scott Steiner versus Sid?
Dude, this is the final ever Halloween Havoc.
Oh, my God.
Halloween Havoc 2000. October the 29th of 2000 from Las Vegas, Nevada.
All right.
You seem very unimpressed with this selection. Well, was there something you had in mind?
There's nothing I had in mind. I will say, though, I would like to do maybe something that's not a pay-per-view eventually. Maybe like a movie some sort of weird special.
Okay, well, let's do we'll do the next 2 weeks with the Halloween Havocs, and then the following one after that, you pick whatever we're going to review. Okay?
Right.
So you put the thinking cap on, and we'll go that direction.
Cool.
Maybe we should alternate each week. 1 week I'll pick something to review. The next week you do it.
That's good.
Does that work? All right. So that's all for this week on Review Away. Thanks thanks to Chris Cruz for chatting with us. Next week it'll be Halloween Havoc 2000. So Wei Ting, as we sign off here, what tune should we be going out with here?
Well, I felt a bit bad, John, about our review last week with Heroes of Wrestling. As you know, and everybody knows, with the passing of Captain Lou Albano. So, I would like to hear, in dedication to him, the Super Mario Brothers Super Show theme song.
Do the Mario swing your arms from side to side. Come on, it's time to go. Do the Mario, take one step. And then again, let's do the Mario all together now. You got it. It's the Mario. Do the Mario, swing your arms from side to side. Come on, it's time to go. Do the Mario, take one step. And then again, let's do the Mario all together now. Come on now, just like that.